Good morning. We are in Isaiah chapter 66 this morning. Last time we were together, I told you we would finish up the book and then have an overview of the chapter. I printed off for you an outline done by Chuck Swindoll, who is a great teacher in my opinion, and he did an outline of every book in the Bible, and so I printed off the one that he has and handed that out, so we'll be looking at that at the end of today's lesson. Let's go ahead and turn to Isaiah 66, if you're not there already, and we'll start with verse 1. Thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me, and where is the place of my rest? Now, God is not asking a question saying, I am king of the world, now where are the things you have given me? I want to see them now. God is stating, look, I am the king of the world, there is nothing you can give me I don't already own. Whatever wood you use to build the house, I created the wood. Whatever bricks you use, the materials you use to build a chair or to build a footstool for me to rest my feet on, God says, I am the one who created those materials. So we often think that we are giving God great things by imparting upon him our possessions. And God just smiles. It's like a child who goes to the garden that the mother has been tilling now for months, and putting her sweat and tears into that garden to create beauty. And the child walks outside and plucks a flower from the garden that the mother designed, that the mother worked on. And the child brings his flower to the mother and with a big smile says, Mommy, I got something for you. Now, there's two responses. What are you doing to my garden? Or thank you, son. Or thank you, daughter. Right? Now, the thank you would not be thank you for all the work you put into it. The child didn't put any work into it. Thank you would be thank you for the offer. Thank you for the love that you're showing me. You know, God owns everything. God owns me. God owns you. God owns the world. God owns everything in the world. Anything we offer him is just a gesture of love. A gesture of love. It is not something God doesn't already own. Every breath we take is given to us by God. So let's offer him these gestures of love, but recognize we're just returning back to God what is already his. Verse 2, for all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord, but to this man will I look even to him that is poor and of a contrite or humble spirit and trembleth at my word. This God of all the earth, this King of kings, what is he looking for? He's looking for humility. God is saying, I'm not looking for you to seek to outshine me. God says, I'm not looking for competition. I'm looking for those who will serve me humbly. The closer we get to God, the more we should recognize how much glory he deserves and how fortunate we are to be able to serve him. There are Christians who I don't believe are truly connected closely to God because their service seems to me service of pride. And I don't know how you could be in the presence of God, truly, sincerely in the presence of God, and yet serve in pride. The only way that can be done is you're not truly in the presence of God. Verse 3, he that killeth an ox is as if he slew a man or murdered. He that sacrificeth a lamb as if he cut off a dog's neck. Cruelty to animals. He that offereth an oblation as if he offered swine's blood, which would be a blasphemous thing to do in the Old Testament. He that burneth incense as if he blessed an idol. Yea, they have chosen their own ways and their soul delighteth in their abominations. God is describing the current state of worship in the nation of Israel. God is saying, here you are killing an ox, slaughtering the lamb, offering incense, all of which, all three things, were asked of God in the Old Testament of the Jews. There's lots of instructions on what kind of animals to kill, how to kill them, how to offer them. So these Jews are doing exactly what God asked, but exactly on the outside. They are following through, going through the motions of outward obedience to God. And yet, in your hearts, God says, when I see your sacrifice, I see murder. When I see your sacrifice, I see cruelty. When I see your sacrifice, I see idolatry. God says, I don't see what you claim to be showing me on the outside. Why? Because what does God see? The hearts. God sees the heart. Told that to Samuel. When Samuel was choosing the next king, God says, I look on the hearts of men. I don't look on the outward appearance. That's nothing new. For thousands of years, since the beginning of time, God has looked on the hearts. Then why is it that we as humanity put so much effort on the outward appearance when God puts so much emphasis on the heart condition? Well, I think it's because we don't see the heart condition, do we? We see the outward. And since we see the outward, we focus on the outward. But we need to see as God sees. That does not mean I see the heart of you and you see the heart of me. That's not truly possible. That means focus on your own heart condition and let God deal with the rest. God sees our heart. God cares about our heart much more than he does about these outward measures of supposed obedience. Outward forms of worship do not equal inward sincerity. Just because someone goes to church regularly, just because someone looks good on the outside, does not mean, oh, you know what, they must be the best of Christians. That's making an assumption, making a judgment call that you can't make based off of how they look on the outside. So many people have been jaded by Christians, by spiritual leaders, because they assumed that since they are a pastor, since they are a teacher, since they are a churchgoer of any kind, they must be a good Christian, only to find out that these supposed good Christians lead very horrible lives. And when that horrible life comes from the closet to the open, people say, well, if that's Christianity, I don't want it. Here's the truth. It was never Christianity to begin with. I'm not saying they weren't saved. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Christianity. It is possible for someone to be saved and not live a life of Christianity as God designed it. So those who don't live an inward Christian life are not living an outward Christian life. You cannot have one without the other. Verse 4, I also will choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them, because when I called, none did answer. When I spake, they did not hear, but they did evil before mine eyes and chose in that which I delighted not. God says, I'm going to punish them, but did you notice specifically how God stated I would punish the rebellious? I will punish the rebellious with the very fears they are most anxious about. Those who are anxious of losing a relationship, God says, if they're rebellious, I'll take that relationship from them. Those who are anxious of losing a possession, God says, if they're rebellious, I'll take that possession from them. Those who are anxious and fearful of losing their health, God says, that's what I'll use to judge them if they're rebellious. Now, this is not a promise for today, but it is a manner in which God said, I will judge the Israelites 2,000 years ago. And although God does not say this is how I will judge my church, we do serve the same God. And that is interesting how God is using the fears of the Jews to judge them in their rebellion. Verses 5 and 6. Hear the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Lord be glorified, but he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. A voice of noise from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice of the Lord that rendereth recompense to his enemies. Verse 5, what's going on? Hear the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at his word. So those who truly love God, those who are truly serving God, that's the first part of verse 5. Your brethren that hated you also hated who? God. Why did they hate you? Because you love God. They hate you, cast you out for who? God says, my sake. Now, did God ask the Jews to cast out those who followed Christ, followed God? No. But they're doing it supposedly in the name of God. Just as the Apostle Paul was going from city to city and arresting the church and casting them into prison and seeing them killed, he claimed he was zealous for God. He said, I was doing it for God. But then God met him on the road to Damascus and said, why are you kicking against the pricks? Why are you pushing against conviction? You've known this was not for me. You've claimed you were doing this for me, but you've known all along. Your conviction has confirmed it. You were doing wrong. But people choose to ignore their convictions and hold tight to their beliefs. And those aren't always the same thing. Religions, and that's my point here, is that the world often uses religion to attack the righteous. I believe that there are many answers. I believe there are those who are deceived, truly believe their religion is the right way, and therefore persecute and attack anyone who disagrees with their religion because they've been deceived into thinking this is the truth. Then I believe there are those who are not deceived, and they just want power, and they use religion to wield that power over those who would dare answer them. Whether it's deception or a lust for power, unfortunately, what happened 2,000 years ago still happens today. Religion is used as a club to beat the righteous over the head. When I was in Washington, D.C., this was some years ago, I was visiting with our state senators, and their office personnel ended up actually meeting me because they were too busy. So I met with the office personnel. We were discussing Christian schools and the Christian school movement and the freedom of Christian schools in Connecticut, what is going on and what it should look like. And as we were discussing Christian schools and discussing Christianity and the freedom of Christianity and the need for Christianity, the senator's office personnel, because, again, I wasn't meeting with the senator, she looked at me and said, look, you understand that the senator's a Christian, right? She goes to church all the time. And I thought, well, that I didn't say this. I thought, well, that's very ironic because I know that your senator stands for abortion. I know that the senator is for things that are opposite of the Bible. And yet this person is saying, no, you can't claim that we're making wrong choices because we're Christians, too, she says, essentially. Yes, that is true, Sam. That someone's definition of Christianity would not be the definition of Christianity that I would hold to, which is the Bible. So this is nothing new, as I've stated. Religion is often used to beat down the righteous, and that's what's happening here in Israel. Let's go on to verses 7 through 14. I will not be reading all these verses. We'll kind of jump around now. You can read them on your own if you'd like. But verse 7, before she travailed, she brought forth. What's going on here? A woman is having a baby. But before she even had labor pains, she's holding the baby in her arms. There was no labor pains. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man-child. Who hath heard such a thing? Like, when did that ever happen in the history of the world, outside of course, medicine? But even with medicine and even with epidurals, there's still pain involved. What woman had a child with no pain involved? And yet God is saying as an illustration, that's what happened. Now, what is he illustrating? In verse 8, he says, "So a nation be born at once, for as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Shall I bring to birth and not cause to bring forth? Saith the Lord, shall I cause to bring forth and shut the womb, saith the Lord." So God says, all right, if I'm going to allow this child to be born, will I not allow the child to thrive? And then, if I bring forth this child, will I shut the womb so that the woman, or in this case, Israel, Jerusalem, who's illustrated through a birth and of a woman, he says, will I shut the womb of Israel so that they can no longer bring forth more? Verse 10, "Rejoice ye with Jerusalem and be glad with her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn for her." Those who love Israel should rejoice when God brings them to a place of glory. Those who are mourning with Israel in their pain and suffering should rejoice with them in their day of glory. Verse 11, "That ye may suck and be satisfied with the breast of her consolation, that ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory," meaning that not only will Israel come to a day of glory, but other nations will benefit from Israel's glory. Nothing new, just like Abraham was told, nations will be blessed by you, not just Israel, other nations. Now, you can skip down to verse 14. "And when you see this, your heart shall rejoice and your bones shall flourish like an herb. And the hand of the Lord shall be known toward his servants and his indignation toward his enemies." What's going on? This, of course, is a future event. You'll find that in verse 12, this future event, the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream will come into Israel and benefit from her glory. That has not happened since this time. Now, this is after David. This is after Solomon. Since the time of Isaiah, this has not happened. And it will happen in the future. When will this happen? During the millennial reign. There are many theologians, as I was studying this passage, most of the theologians I read about believed this took place with the church. Except, I don't believe that's the case. Because God is talking to Israel. God is talking to a nation. God is not talking to a church. Many believe this took place when Christ was born, and that the Messiah brought forth the culmination of this prophecy. Again, I do not believe that's the case. Christ was born, yes, but the Gentile nations come to Israel and glory with Israel because Christ was born from them. Not with Israel. They gloried in Christ. The church gloried in Christ, but not with the nation of Israel. They did not. I believe this is a millennial reign. When Christ returns, overnight, in the blink of an eye, Christ is going to return, right? And when he does, then he is going to destroy his enemies. And then, immediately, a nation will be formed in glory. What nation will be formed in glory? Zion. By the way, Jerusalem is often referred to as Zion, and it's referred to as Zion many times in its future glorious state. Yes, also in its current Old Testament form, Zion, but the word Zion is essentially a word that kind of refers to a place of paradise, and Jerusalem being that place of paradise. And I can tell you, Jerusalem's not that place now. But it will be when Christ returns for 1,000 years and reigns on the earth, Zion will become a place of paradise, a location of glory for the nation of Israel. And Gentile nations will flow into Israel at that time and benefit from the glory of the Jews that Christ has established through his reign on this earth. So this is a future prophecy, in my opinion. Verse 15, for behold, the Lord will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with the flames of fire. So again, this seems to be the future. He starts with the time of paradise, the millennial reign, but then he kind of backtracks and talks about the tribulation period now. That time of judgment before his reign on earth. He says, my wrath will become upon the world like flames of fire. Verse 16, for by fire and by a sword will the Lord plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. This makes a lot of sense when you compare this passage to Revelation and the future time that we read about in Revelation. During the tribulation, God will bring the nations together for judgment. Look at verse 17. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the gardens behind one tree in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination of the mouse, shall be consumed together, saith the Lord. Verse 17 again, look at the first part. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves. Those who seek righteousness through their own actions, these are the ones God is talking about right here. The self-righteous. Now, that term self-righteous is often referred to in common terms as someone who's prideful, thinks better of themselves, nose lifted in the air, treats others like they're trash. Oh, you're self-righteous. The term self-righteous, though, literally means someone who claims to have attained righteousness on their own, by themselves. That's self-righteousness. Now, if you could do that, that would lead to a lot of pride. But the truth is you can't. Self-righteousness is a lie. Self-righteousness is an oxymoron. It's a word that attacks itself and cannot be true because part of the definition defeats the other part of the definition. The self part defeats the righteous part, and the righteous part defeats the self part. You cannot put them together and come up with a definition that makes biblical sense, theological sense. And yet there's a lot of Christians who would say, no, 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 I got saved. Christ saved me. I didn't save myself. But if they were honest, they believe that since that moment of taking a knee at the cross, everything else has been them. They would not state, a lot of evangelical Christians would not state they're going to heaven because of what they've done or who they are. They would claim it's Christ. But they would state, where I'm at today, I've gotten myself here. Christ pulled me out of sin. Christ pulled me out of self-destruction, set my feet on the ground, and I took it from there. And I went the rest of the way on my own. And I've attained righteousness up to this point through my own choices. That's self-righteousness. And that is why these Christians walk around thinking they're better than others because they believe they've attained on their own what you have not. The truth is, Christ got us to the point of salvation, and Christ will get us to the point of paradise. And everything in between. If I'm getting anywhere, I'm getting there by the grace of God. If I've arrived anywhere, I've arrived anywhere by the strength of Christ. If I've made any good decisions, I've made those decisions by the wisdom of the Holy Spirit. Anything, going back to verse 1 of chapter 66, anything we offer to God was already His to begin with. And anything that God, that I've attained because God gave it to me. And if I offer my service to God, it's because God has allowed me to serve Him. God has given me the strength, wisdom, and perseverance to serve Him. It was not me that got myself here. It was me that clung to Christ to this point. And so God is talking about those He will judge, and it's interesting how He states, those I'll judge are the self-righteous, those who think they've attained on their own without me. Verse 18, for I know their works and their thoughts. It shall come that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. They'll see His glory, all right, but not in the way they would like to. Because He's going to gather them for what? Verse 16, by fire, by the sword, the Lord will plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. They're going to see His glory as God says, you've made bad decisions. You've sought righteousness outside of me. You sought religion outside of the Bible. And because of that, you didn't attain either a sincere, true religion or righteousness. Verses 19 through 20. And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations to Tarshish, Pul, Lud, that draw the bow, to Tubal, Javan, to the isles afar off, that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. Now, this is where it gets a little confusing. If the middle part of this chapter is speaking of the millennial reign, which I'm convinced it is, and if the verses we just read are speaking of the time right before that millennial reign, which is the tribulation, then these verses we're reading now, verses 19 and 20, are bridging the gap between the tribulation to the millennial reign, or kind of that earlier part of the millennial reign. So how is it that people are still alive in the millennial reign if they haven't heard of the glory of God? Because, as I've stated, as Revelation states, as other prophetic books state, all unsaved will perish at that time. Only the saved will enter into the millennial reign. So how can this verse be true if the context that I'm giving it to you is accurate? Here's what I believe. I don't believe you need to know everything about God to be saved. I think the bare minimum is understanding who Christ is and what He did for you and accepting by faith His sacrifice. That's not a whole lot of information you need to know to be saved. You need to know enough about Christ. There is so much more about God than just Christ came to this earth, sacrificed on the cross so that you could be saved, a perfect God for imperfect man, imperfect woman. And in faith, if we trust that sacrifice, He promises to save you. There is so much more about God than that. And let's be transparent. Aren't we still learning about the glories of God even today? Do you know everything about God? Do you know about all His glories even today? Having been saved for decades, most of us in this room, literally decades, and we are still learning about the glories of God. Have we seen the glories of God? Some of us have seen some glorious things. Have we seen all the glories of God? No, we have not. There's some in this room who maybe haven't seen much of God's glory, but they still believe. So don't be concerned when you read this text and say, wait a second, if they are saved, why would they need to be told about the glories of God? Well, then what are we doing this morning? Why are you here? You are saved and you're being told about the glories of God. Basically, during the millennial reign, God is going to continue missionaries and evangelists being sent out, continue sending them out to proclaim the glories of God. A missionary and evangelist are not just for the purpose of leading the unsaved to salvation, to Christ. They are also for the purpose of leading the saved to a deeper understanding of God's glory. God is going to send out teachers across the world to instruct them on the glories of God. But also remember this. Children will be born during the millennial reign. And these children will also need to be taught of the glories of God and need to be saved. So these evangelists and missionaries, although at the beginning will only be preaching to the saved, within a decade or two, easily, children will be born, and then they'll start teaching to the unsaved as well as the saved. Verse 21. And I will also take of them for priests and for Levites, saith the Lord. For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I shall make, shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. God says Israel will last forever. That's a promise. That's a covenant he made with Abraham, with David, with others in the Old Testament, the patriarchs, to the Jews in general. He promised them, your nation will last forever. You have a king who will reign forever in the name of Israel. He's reminding them of that promise now. He says, even when I make a new heaven and a new earth, I will not destroy the nation of Israel. They will continue on in the new heaven and new earth. It shall come to pass, verse 23, that from one new moon to another and from one Sabbath to another shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. For eternity, people will flow in to worship God. Here's how I see it. I do not see it that every individual for eternity will only sit at the feet of Christ and worship for all times. I believe there are other things that are going to be going on during eternity than just worshiping God. But I do believe there will be a constant flow of people to the throne of God so that any moment of any time, someone's plural will be at the throne of God worshiping Him. It'll be a constant flow of worship towards God. Christ will receive the worship from all the living for eternity. And in verse 24, and they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me. For their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched, and they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh. There's only two ways to look at verse 24. One, that God is saying for eternity you'll be able to view those in hell. I don't believe that's the case. The only other way to view this is the physical side. After the tribulation, after Christ comes and destroys the earth, we are told that the carcasses will be gathered for months. And now we're informed how they'll be disposed of. They will not be buried. There will be a large pit. They'll be dumped and they'll be burned. And God says, we're not putting out the fire. That fire will keep going and keep going and keep going for people to walk by and to look into this body. I don't think it'll be one pit. There's no pit big enough. Pits, plural, right? But at least one pit. By the way, this is pretty standard in the Old Testament. Cities would build large pits, large holes, and after a war, that's what would happen. They couldn't bury every single body. And so they would build large holes, dig large holes, throw the bodies in there and burn them. And as people walked into the city, there would be a massive smoke ball coming up somewhere in the distance from the burned bodies. And God is saying, that's what's going to happen. And God is saying, I will use that as an illustration to those who were saved and survived the tribulation into the millennial reign. They will be able to see this is what happens to the enemies of God. Christian, we don't have to worry about this time. We won't be alive during this time. But we have loved ones who may be alive during this time because they have not accepted Christ. And so are we going to live out Christ sincerely, as we stated earlier, not the outward flow of obedience to God, purely just obedience only, and no inward worship attached? Because although man only sees the outward, there are those who have the ability to see past your facade into a glimpse of your heart, and they can see the hypocrisy. And that is when I believe much damage is done. When the world sees past the facade into the hypocrisy. Don't let that be said of you. Okay, well, we passed out the outline of Isaiah as well. We have some time now to go over the entire book. And what a journey it has been, the book of Isaiah. So let's kind of briefly just cover what we discussed over most of last year. You can see where Charles Swindoll, great teacher again. He has a website where a lot of his stuff, he taught many, many years ago. I remember listening to him when I was a kid. I'm 38 now, so that kind of put things in perspective. And I remember as a kid thinking I liked him. He was very clear as a child. I could understand what he would say. I remember listening to a radio, and he would give a short devotional. The radio stations would put up just a short blurb. And I would think, wow, I actually learned something from that old guy on the radio when I was like 14 or 12 years old. And so, a very clear teacher. But if you see the breakdown that he gave of the book of Isaiah, He states that the verse 39 chapters deal heavily with the judgment of God. Now, that is the case. Now, if you remember, we didn't end God's judgment at chapter 39. We still read about God's judgment upon other nations, the nation of Israel specifically, even here at the final chapter, chapter 66. God's judgment is still being addressed. But what he's saying, I think, here, and which I agree with, is the first 39 chapters are pretty much the emphasis is God's judgment on other nations. The nation of Israel and those that surrounded Israel, which is why chapter after chapter, God brings up a nation and then he brings up the prophetic judgment that will come upon them. He talks about Israel and the prophetic judgment upon them. And then in the next chapter, another nation is brought up. In some chapters, multiple nations brought up and just judgment everywhere. And then chapters 40 through 48, the emphasis shifts from the judgment upon mankind to the sovereignty, supremacy, Chuck Swindoll says here, of the Lord. God's sovereignty, God's authority over all the nations. Then in chapters 49 through 53, lots of emphasis on the Messiah, the servant of the Lord, specifically the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Yes, other things are discussed outside of the Messiah and messianic prophecies, but this is where you find a lot of those. Also, God's promise of deliverance to the Jews, not just specifically about Jesus, but during these chapters, you read about, you know, a lot about how God wants to deliver them and where he wants to take them and where they'll end up in paradise during the millennial reign. And then the final part of the book, 54 through 66, focuses a lot on the future and the millennial reign in general, that God basically says over and over again in so many ways, I've got a plan for you. This is temporary. Your pain, your suffering, you're going through it because of the judgment, chapters 1 through 39, that you deserve. But that's not the end game. That's not where I want to leave you. I want to bring you further. And so chapters 54 through 66, as Chuck Swindoll says, are texts of hope. Which are great, because the first part of the book deals with disobedience and rebellion, and the last part of the book deals with hope. What a great way to deal with the issues of the rebellious heart. So many times we as parents, we dish out the judgment, but we give very little hope. I'm going to ground you forever. Well, there's no hope in that statement. You're never going to, well, there's no hope in that statement. I will never trust you again. There's no hope in that statement. Judgment's necessary, but so is hope. Otherwise, what's the point? Why bother trying? I was speaking with a young man not long ago, and he said, you know, I would work at churches, you know, just kind of as a layperson, I was working at churches. And he said, pastors would get impatient with me. Maybe I was a young man. I was not what they wanted to be, who they needed me to be. And they would get impatient with me. And he said they would just give up on me. They would no longer seek to help me or assist me. And he said, I just lost hope. I realized there's nothing else for me here. This person has no desire to help me go any further. So what's the point? So they would leave. This person would go from church to church to church. Because if you don't have hope in any kind of future growth, then what are you doing? And so we as parents, we as grandparents, aunts, and uncles need to give the children under our care hope. Yes, correction. Yes, redirection. But hope. There is something better for you. He says the Bible within the Bible, the first chapters, 1 through 39, heavily dealing with Old Testament law. And then chapters 40 through 66 deal with the New Testament grace of God. And I would agree with that. You do find a lot of God's grace and mercy. A lot of the New Testament prophecies of, again, specifically the millennial reign and the Messiah, dealing with the Gospels and future events that the books of chapter 44 through 66 are dealing a lot with future events that take place in the New Testament or the book of Revelation. The theme, he gives to both the justice and mercy of God. And I think that's great. The justice and mercy of God is both heavily, heavily dealt with. Whenever you see God's justice, almost immediately God's mercy is given. Whenever there's a chapter that is heavily justice, you'll find either within that chapter at the end or by the next chapter, the next couple chapters, God's mercy is given as well. And then you have some key verses. You can look at those on your own time. And Christ in Isaiah prophesied throughout. Born of a virgin, chapter 7, verse 14. the Sim of Jesse, chapter 11, the Suffering Servant, chapter 53. Those are just a few. There are many other locations, if you remember our study in Isaiah, many, many texts that dealt directly with the Messiah and prophecies of him. And that is the book of Isaiah.